In this episode of This Week in Space, we wade into the orbital junkyard, the dangerous mass of millions of bits of space debris orbiting our planet. Up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 3, recorded March 18th, 2022. The Orbital Junkyard. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV has everything you need to level up your IT skills while you enjoy the journey. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use code TWIT30 at checkout. And by Blue Land. Sometimes in order to go green, you've got to get blue. Blue Land, that is. Blue Land was founded on the belief that a cleaner planet starts by reducing waste while creating powerful, effective cleaners for your entire home. Get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/space. Welcome to This Week in Space. I'm Rod Pyle, your roving editor of Ad Astra Magazine, here with the legendary Tarek Malik of space.com. How you doing, Tarek?
Doing well, Rod, doing well.
Hey, you'll be shocked to know I have a joke for you.
I'm all ears.
You are, okay. You're vibrating. You're so excited. Hey, Tarek, did you hear that NASA actually launched a herd of cows into orbit?
No, Rod. I did not hear that.
It was a herd shot round the world.
I love it.
In lame NASA, faux NASA news, a group of students are designing a new rocket that updates its Facebook status as it launches. It's an attention-seeking missile. All right.
That one was good.
I think that laugh was almost real. All right. So we're actually here today to take our friends and our audience through a tour of the swimming mass of debris orbiting our planet, known as orbital debris, which is a looming, clear and present danger. So warm up your radar and prepare for evasive maneuvers. But first, we're going to go through some headlines.
Let's do it.
Let's talk about the Energizer helicopter. So we've got the Mars
helicopter. Ingenuity, right?
Ingenuity, right. Mars helicopter that went up on the Perseverance rover. It's flown 21 times, and it was designed to fly. They were expecting 3 flights, hoping for 5. They got 25, which is pretty amazing. So they've extended the mission once again. It's been doing this for a year, so it's rolling into a second year of operation, which I think is pretty amazing. We always expect JPL's hardware to extend its warranty or to work past its warranty, quote unquote, its primary mission. But this is pretty amazing. And from what I've read, we're entering a whole new regime of terrain here as we move into the delta in Jezero crater.
So, yeah, I mean, this is like a really big deal. You know, we didn't think that that Ingenuity was going to get much more beyond the month that NASA and JPL had agreed on. There's always a lot of talk about could the team even support the helicopter team as well as Perseverance. And this seems like they've gotten a bit of a handle on how they want to operate this kind of reconnaissance drone in that kind of a mode now. It's not really like a test vehicle anymore. They're using it to kind of look around and scout the terrain ahead of time. I just think it's really interesting that it's like a little leapfrog type of a process where Perseverance will drive a little bit and then the helicopter will pop up and fly over and then land and then wait, and Perseverance will drive some more. So it's really nice to see this little drone that could do so well.
Yeah, and you bring up an interesting point, which is this thing originally when it undocked from the underside of the rover and dropped to the ground.
undocked is gentle. They just dropped it.
They just dropped it. But I think a lot of folks, at least people I was talking to, thought, oh, so it comes back into a dock to charge, right? And the answer is no, it doesn't. Once it was separated from the rover, the only thing that keeps it linked is a radio signal. So as you say, the rover drives and the helicopter catches up, or the helicopter flies ahead and the rover catches up. So never again will the two meet except in general proximity. And it's operating off of a small solar panel above its propeller. The nice thing about being a Mars helicopter, of course, is when you go up and move around, you have a chance to shake off some of that dust that may settle on your solar panel. So that's a good thing. But this new region rises up about 130 feet above the crater floor from where they've been. And it's kind of rough, and it's got cliffs and some angled surfaces and angled flat areas and sandy pockets. So it's entering new terrain, which is a bigger challenge for the rover than it is for the helicopter. I mean, it wants a safe place to land, but it's pretty light, and it's got a nice wide set of feet there, so it's not going to tip over. But still, it's a new regime, and every time they change the kind of terrain they're flying into or the conditions they're flying in, that's different. And they're also extending the altitude and the range and the speed it can fly. So it's now allowed to go above 50 feet. It doesn't have a software limit there, and is going to be allowed to fly a little further and faster, which all adds up to better reconnaissance for the rover. So as you point out, this started as an experiment just to see if they could do it. And I thought that they were going to end this after solar conjunction, because my understanding was that they were done leapfrogging, but apparently not. And this has been extended possibly as much as another year. So I think that's really astonishing.
You know, I think that you can probably expect that this little helicopter will keep flying until it can't anymore. And that NASA will find the money. You know, there was actually a lot of questions before Perseverance even launched. If Ingenuity, as it came to be known, it was just Mars Helicopter for years as a concept, was even going to be added to the mission. And they added it kind of, you know, down to the wire to as late as they could. When then Administrator Jim Bridenstine was the one that said, yeah, we should really do this. We've got it. We've got the technology. Let's try it. And they were able to get it on board. And now it's paying off in spades. You know, they thought maybe 1 month, like you said, a few flights. They're crossing this region called, I think you pronounce it CETA. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. But they got to take 3 flights to get across that that area to do the scouting for Perseverance.
All right. Well, that's exciting, and fingers crossed for it to last another, well, heck, the way some of these the rover projects go, maybe it'll last the full 20 years of the life of the rover. Probably not. But, hey, next. Yes?
I was just going to say, Perseverance's predecessors, ooh, that's hard to say it like 10 times fast, but Spirit and Opportunity, those rovers lasted, you know, many, many times more than their 3 months. I think, what was it, like a dozen years or so for Opportunity?
Spirit was, I think, 6 years, maybe not even that much. Spirit was fairly short-lived, but Opportunity, yeah, I think 14, 15 years.
Yeah.
And that's on solar panels.
Exactly.
So you get Perseverance with a nuclear power pack on the back, and now you're really talking about something. Speaking of talking about cool technology, although not the most up-to-date technology necessarily, we saw the rollout of the beast yesterday. Finally, the Space Launch System came trundling out. Well, trundling might be a bit of an exaggeration. Came slowly rolling out of the Vehicle Assembly Building at the Kennedy Space Center yesterday. And I just got some pictures from one of our reporters there. I assume you've got a few of them as well. Pretty spectacular. The livery is not quite what we had expected from early on. There was some talk about possibly painting the main tank white. That didn't happen. We've gone back to what we did with the shuttle, which is just that bare orange foam. But it's the first time we've seen a great, big, tall, spectacular moon rocket roll out of that thing since 1975.
That's right.
That wasn't a moon rocket. That was a Skylab rocket, but big deal.
Well, so this is kind of the end all. It's been about 18 years since the original version of this rocket was laid out on paper back then. For the it was a version of it, Ares 5 for Constellation Ares 5, program. Yeah. Then it became a Space Launch System, and now here it is for Artemis. I mean, I'm just getting to this point seems like a major milestone. And there is that thread there. You mentioned Rod that kind of throwback to the Saturn V era, the Saturn rocket era. The same crawlers that they used for that, they used the Apollo vintage era crawler for this one too. Our writer, our senior writer, Chelsea Goad, was there. She said it was amazing, that it looked spectacular. You know, it is NASA's most powerful rocket, you know, since the Saturn V. And this is, you know, if everything goes well, this would be the rocket that will launch the next people, the next astronauts to the moon, if all the tests they're going to do work. It took about 11 and a half hours for them to roll out of the VAB, yeah, the Vehicle Assembly Building, High Bay 3. on its the special carrier, and it just settled down actually early Friday morning, early this morning at 4:15 a.m. is what they said. So 322 feet, pretty big rocket to get up there. So we'll have to wait. I wonder what that elevator ride is going to be like to get to the top of that thing. So
we're going to talk about this probably next week, unless another major story intervenes. But it's interesting. It's constantly touted as NASA's most powerful rocket yet. And yet, because of that upper stage design, it can't loft as much mass to the moon as the Saturn V did.
Yeah.
Which is kind of counterintuitive. So it took a very long explanation that I had to read to completely understand why that is. But nonetheless, it's a great big rocket. It's cool. It's validated to carry people long before Starship will be. So, you know, fingers crossed that everything works out. It's going to be expensive to launch, but at least we've got it, and that's good. And with any luck, we'll see it taking off this summer, and we'll see which one of us owes the other one. What was our bet for? I wanted your chair.
I'm not going to give you
my Star Trek chair. Okay, it's a matter of public record. We'll discuss that.
You mentioned the livery. I'll just point out the fact that NASA has really leaned into their old school worm logo from the, the 70s and 80s. And so on the side of this towering rocket is just the giant NASA worm. And it's nice to see that kind of legacy in there. I think a lot of people think it's really retro now. And so it's just an example of leaning in. But you see ESA's logo is on there too, because the Orion spacecraft is on this rocket and there's a European service module on it. So it's already an international partnership going on.
We don't paint out our partner's logo like the Russians do. And speaking of the Russians,
that's right.
Just a quick one. We have comrades still working hand in hand in orbit. So we're told that operations are continuing as normal aboard the International Space Station, despite the war in Ukraine, which is good news. I don't think any of us really thought they were going to come to blows and there might be a little less conversation going on than there was in the past, but they're still getting along, which is good. And as I think you discussed last week, U.S. astronaut Mark Vanderhey will still return to Russia aboard the Soyuz at the end of March, which would have me chewing my fingernails a bit. But he says he's not nervous. And, you know, he's an astronaut. The other guys are cosmonauts. And
they've been training together. They've been training together for years. They've lived together for nearly a year. So there's an esprit de corps there that I think is a little bit transcendent of a lot of the political lines that we have here on our planet. And they're not alone. Things are still busy. There was a spacewalk by two American astronauts at the space station this year. Right. That went off just fine. Three cosmonauts just earlier today, as we were speaking, launched to the space station. They're going to arrive this afternoon. Things seem to be going apace. So, Mark Vanderhey, he does come back to Earth on March 30th, and he is the record holder now for the longest space flight by an American astronaut, getting longer every day until he comes back to Earth. So,
well, that's cool, and that's all good. But I did note that that NASA is still planning to test the reboost capability of the Cygnus cargo vessel when it docks with the ISS in a couple of months. So I guess there is still a concern about the Russians deciding they're done with this in 2024, 2025. And that big question mark about, can you operate the space station without Russian cooperation, especially when it comes to keeping it up in a proper orbit, correct?
In fact, I think that Cygnus is already at the space station. I believe they launched it last month there. But that was, this was before all of the political issues that the U.S. and Russia in terms of cooperation in space have been facing. They had planned to do that as a new use for the vehicle. I'm sure in the back of everyone's minds, having that kind of redundancy is good. It will be interesting to see if some of the other vehicles, because Elon Musk has said, hey, maybe they could try with Dragon. I'm not sure Dragon has the thrusters in the right place to do that. If other private companies, I think Boeing is only the only other one right now, might be trying to follow suit and build that capability in.
But we know Mr. Musk can do it if he wants, because he'll just rig something. All right. Well, this has all been grand. Let's take a quick break to hear about our sponsors. And next up, the Orbital Junkyard. We'll be right back. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Now, if you're a regular listener to this show, you know that we're entering a new space age. Between NASA, Space Force, and companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and dozens of others, they need people qualified in IT. These skills are more indispensable than ever. IT Pro TV can be a stepping stone to a career in the most exciting adventure of the 21st century. Are you thinking about getting your CCNA certification? Having your CCNA shows you're knowledgeable in networking fundamentals, IP services, security fundamentals, automation, and programmability. IT Pro TV has the classes and skills you need in everything Cisco. And the month of March is dedicated to Cisco at IT Pro TV. Check out their free weekend, March 19th and 20th, including these courses: Cisco CCT Routing and Switching, 100 through 490, and Cisco CCNA, 200 through 301, and a variety of others. Learn to get certified in IT in a way that works with your schedule and is actually entertaining. IT Pro TV has 7 studios that are filming Monday through Friday, and those courses go from the studio to their course library in 24 hours. They make sure that you're prepared for your exams with their virtual labs and practice tests. You don't want to miss IT Pro TV's March webinars either. On March 24th, check out the Cisco NAAS webinar featuring Anthony Sequeira. Don't forget, your IT team needs to level up and enjoy the journey. Check out an IT Pro TV business plan for your team today. Visit itpro.tv/twit for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use code TWIT30. That's itpro.tv/twit and use code TWIT30 for an additional 30% off the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV. Build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. And just like orbiting debris, we're back. So let's talk about the Orbital Junkyard. If you've seen the movie Gravity, you know the deal. You know what we're talking about. There's a lot of space junk in orbit. This includes old rocket stages, debris from derelict stages that have exploded, defunct satellites, crash satellites, bits of icy fuel. Even paint flakes are enough to do damage at the speeds that things are moving in orbit. And notably, in the bad old days, before we learned to vent rocket stages, and I'm not sure that all of them do this yet, but as we went along and realized that upper rocket stages exploded as their fuels froze in orbit, we learned to create vents so they wouldn't do that. But the ones that did explode and or do explode still create tons and tons of orbital debris. So why does this matter? Well, at orbital speeds, at 17,500 miles an hour, even a little chip of paint the size of a dime nearly took out the front couple of panels of a window in the space shuttle years ago. And big bits are much worse. So you get something the size of a golf ball, let's say, at these speeds, especially if they're moving at tangents to each other or against each other, in other words, coming in opposite directions, and the amount of energy they're carrying is really tremendous. And even on the solar panels on the International Space Station, for instance, tiny impacts just from bits of dust can create little plasma clouds that can cause short circuits. So there's all kinds of reasons that orbital debris is bad. But the main one is that there's just a lot of material up there. And whether you're talking about being in orbit with it in this bath of space junk or trying to shoot a spacecraft through it, especially with people aboard, it's a real problem. What do you think?
Well, you know, this is something that is not going to go away now, and it's just a problem that will get worse if we don't take care of it. There's something like 20,000 or so bits of objects that are orbiting the Earth right now that are being tracked. Really, NASA's Orbital Debris Office, they actually have one. It's called the Orbital Debris Program Office under the Astromaterials Research and Exploration Science Department over at, I believe they're at Johnson Space Center. And they've got some stats that say that, you know, while there's 20,000 bits of pieces that they're tracking, there's like half a million marble-sized objects up there,
right,
in Earth's orbit, maybe even 100 million. This is a mind-boggling number to me. But maybe even 100 million objects that are like 1 millimeter, just teeny, teeny, tiny or smaller, that they can't even track. That is an awful lot of junk that that is just up there creating this cloud of debris. And think about, there's 2,000 or so satellites up there right now, somewhere around there. And that stuff that they're kind of swimming in every day. And it is rare. Space is big, so there aren't collisions. But we've seen it several times. There was a crash between two satellites, a Russian defunct satellite and an active communication satellite in the mid-2000s that created two huge swarms of clouds of debris that only is going to go and hit other debris. And that's the fear that space agencies and companies that work in space have is once you have one debris event, it begets other debris, and then that begets more debris, and then you end up with this runaway cascade called the Kessler syndrome, where you just have a massively rapidly expanding amount of junk that will never get better. And so there are companies that need to look at that and maybe even make a business to clean it all up.
Well, so you brought up some of these numbers, and I ain't going to use your fancy metric system because we're recording this in the United States. but let me just refine some of those a little bit. So there's more than 20,000, quote, artificial objects currently in orbit, most non-functional. So I think a much smaller percentage of those are actually still operating. So as you said, 34,000 pieces roughly are baseball-sized or larger. 4,450 are operational satellites, and the rest is just junk. It's worn out stuff or broken stuff or stuff that's past its lifetime. 128 million bits, 1 centimeter, about 1/3 of an inch across in diameter. But even these could puncture a hull of a space station or spacecraft in the right circumstances, the right speeds. Countless smaller bits. And when we say smaller bits, even something just the size of a BB or a pinhead, the broad end of a pin, is enough to do damage to some components because spacecraft aren't heavy. They're built very light for obvious reasons. They have to get up off the ground and into space. And while they have a system that they use, which name escapes me at the moment, it starts with a W, of multi-layering materials on these hulls to try and slow these things down, there's only so much you can do. And again, if you're in an equatorial orbit and something's coming in at a polar orbit as opposed to chasing you down, and it's coming in laterally at you, the speeds can be just really incredible.
Is that the Whipple shield that you're talking
about? Yes, Whipple shield. Thank you. Yeah. I knew it sounded like some kind of a dog breed, Whippets. So Whipple shield. So this is a serious problem. And this debris tends to collect, and this is not an absolute, but it tends to collect in the areas that we traffic the most, right? So most rockets go to certain altitudes within low Earth orbit, and that happens to be where the space station and other crewed operations are being done and will be done. And herein lies the problem. The place where you most want to be is the one where you tend to most go, and that's where stuff ends up collecting. And then on top of that, as you point out, we have the United States in the past, the Soviet Union in the past, doing lots of ASAT tests, less so in the last 20 years, but still the Russians and the Chinese and the Indians have had fairly recent ASAT tests, some worse than others. I think of those three, the most damaging one, if I remember correctly, was the Russian test because of the altitudes at which that debris cloud is created.
Yeah, and that's the one that caused the most concern because it was one that it seemed like it was operating at International Space Station level altitudes where it's debris they're going to have to deal with for a long time, and it just seems extremely reckless. I should point out the United States not immune to this. When after the Chinese anti-satellite test back in 2007, there was a U.S. missile that they launched to destroy a satellite that was falling from space according to the military, to make sure that none of the larger tanks on that satellite, it was called, I believe, USA 193, reached the Earth and contaminated any place because it was falling uncontrolled. But it was also a very clear show that they could launch a missile, that the Navy could launch a missile and hit a satellite that was you know, relatively close to the Earth. So so we've seen that just in the, you know, in the last 15 years or so, a lot of demonstrations to kind of show everyone what's going on, and that's just intentional debris events. They meant to destroy that stuff. One of the things that you mentioned about these tanks that explode is that if something happens with an old satellite, let's say that was launched in the 60s and it's still up there, and we thought it was fine, but you know it gets pinged by a screw or a nut or a bolt that just happens to create some other kind of debris event there. And then it starts to move around. Now it's moving in a place where we didn't know where it was before. And the next thing you know, you have a piece of rocket junk hitting the moon that no one expected. And that was from China's rocket booster that hit the moon. We were all excited about that, but it could easily have fallen somewhere else or hit something. So hit the International Space Station. That kind of a thing is what people are really afraid of. And the space station, as you mentioned, it's solar panels have been dinged by debris. There's a big old gouge out of its robotic arm from a debris strike. And the Hubble Space Telescope, too, when they brought panels home, they're studying how it was pitted over time from debris to wear it down from not just micrometeoroids that's out there naturally, but all of the stuff that we've just left up there or that's fallen off or that astronauts have even thrown overboard. So,
speaking of that, here's a short list of some of the junk that we know of that's been left up there. We've lost at least one glove, although I think it's more than that. The first glove, as I recall, drifted out during the Gemini days, but there's been one or two more since then. Tools, a toothbrush, not quite sure how that happened. And then the Soviet Union, when they were operating the Mir space station, tossed their garbage overboard. And of course, garbage can have organic components or water in it. And when that freezes, it becomes ice, and that might as well be a piece of rock at those speeds. And interestingly, and this is one I hadn't heard of, the Soviet Union used to launch a series of satellites called Rorsat that were military. They were powered by sodium-cooled reactors, and after a number of years, those began leaking coolant, creating clouds of frozen debris of potassium-sodium alloy, which is something I'd never even heard of. But as of 2019, 1,400 bits of various pieces of junk had struck the ISS, and I didn't realize that the number was that high. I knew that they had a couple of small events. And some of these are very small, and a number of them are on the solar panels. And you know, you can ping something through a solar panel; it'll still work, but it does reduce its effectiveness. But that's a lot. And now, of course, we've got ever larger. You know, in the middle of this conversation, we've got ever larger constellations of these broadband satellites going up into orbit. And according to Elon Musk and SpaceX, there's some AI awareness in the satellites on how to avoid each other and how to avoid other things like space stations that we don't want them to hit. But we're talking about in the last couple of years, in 2021, 1,700 satellites were launched, bringing the number of active satellites up to about 4,850, which is a 30% increase in just 2 years. And this is with companies like SpaceX just starting to get their act together in terms of broadband satellites. He's got, I think we were discussing this last week, just under 2,000 in orbit now, if I remember correctly. And he's looking at a minimum of 12,000 and perhaps as many as 40,000. And these are all in low Earth orbit. They're not at the altitude the space station is, but they have to launch up to a similar altitude and then migrate past it. So, you know, just the amount of stuff we're adding on purpose that we can track and maneuver unless they malfunction is a little daunting, especially when you're looking at launching through this belt of stuff, not just existing it, but launching through it to get out to the moon.
Yeah. And we should point out that this is a threat. One of the reasons that the industry is worried about debris is because like most of what we do on a day-to-day basis, how you and I are talking, it all depends on communication and technologies that we get from space. You know, if it's a communication satellite, if it's the science, if you're a scientist, the science of the astronauts, not just on the International Space Station. China has their own space station too. Some companies are planning to build their own private space stations. You know, the astronauts, we should point out, have had to take shelter in their return ships several times, well, just many times, I think, over the years, but just in the last few years, at least like two or three times, because a piece of debris got too close too fast that they couldn't move the space station out of the way in time. There's a pizza box shaped perimeter 25 miles across that NASA doesn't want anything. It's like a keep out zone. They don't want anything that can come that close that could potentially hit this football field sized space station. And so those are reasons why people are trying to track all this. And there are some things that they can do. I think you've got a list, right, of what's being done now.
I do.
Can talk about. Yeah.
And I've got that list because this is just one more fact I want to drop in here because it's a big number. I love big numbers. As of 2009, when there was a lot less of this stuff up there, we were recording 13,000 close calls each week. And that's gone up a lot since then. And so we're going to talk about it as soon as we come back from this break. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Blue Land. Did you know that an estimated 5 billion plastic hand soap and cleaning bottle containers are thrown away each year? And if that's not bad enough, each bottle can be made of more than 90% water. That is a serious lose-lose situation for our planet. I recently had occasion to spend a few hours with an astronaut who flew on the space shuttle and spent time on the Mir space station. And when we discussed looking back at Earth from space, his most profound impression was that he was looking at something beautiful and fragile. And most astronauts say the same thing. They're in a unique position to see something the rest of us can't see directly, that Earth is a wonderful, fragile home, and that it needs our help. Plastic has been found in 100% of marine turtles, almost 60% of whales, over 36% of seals, and 40% of seabird species examined. By 2050, scientists predict that the ocean will contain more plastic by weight than fish. So start creating a cleaner planet from home. Blue Land's idea is simple and beautiful. Buy the bottle once and refill it forever. The only thing you need to discard is your outdated idea that eco-friendly products are more expensive and less effective. You just fill Blue Land's beautiful Instagrammable bottles with warm water, pop in one of the hand soap or spray cleaner tablets, and within minutes you have powerful cleaning products in the most incredible scents, such as iris agave, Perrine lemon, and lavender eucalyptus. From their best-selling clean essentials kit to their hand soap duo and plastic-free laundry and dishwasher tablets, Blue Land has something for every inch of your home. And backed by popular demand is Blue Land's toilet tablet cleaner. Get it before it sells out again. Blue Land's stunning, high-quality, forever bottles start at just $10 when you buy a kit and are meant to be reused forever, with money-saving refill tablets that start at just $2. Try Blue Land today. You'll love it, and your planet will thank you. Right now, you can get 20% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/space. That's 20% off your first order of any Blue Land products at blueland.com/space. That's blueland.com/space. Okay, so let's talk about some solutions.
Yes.
The primary thing we need, I think, is international cooperation, because any individual nation could do a certain amount of work to try and mediate how much stuff they put up there. They could try and mediate what kind of collisions their hardware is involved in, and they could certainly stop doing anti-satellite tests, which would be very nice. But we've got this additional legal problem that needs to be resolved, which is that not just each satellite, but each bit of junk up there belongs to and is the responsibility of its country of origin. So if you have a Russian satellite that's tumbling out of control and you as Russia are unable to go up and get it secured or brought down to a lower orbit so it'll re-enter, I as the United States can't go grab that and take care of it, as I understand, because that is your property. And we still haven't really worked out a legal regime internationally that clearly delineates the responsibilities of countries for their space junk.
Yeah, you know, and that is something that we still have to work out, I think, as a spacefaring species. There's some stuff that many of the companies are doing now to build in an end-of-life plan. I think that's kind of the first thing that we've been seeing proliferate in recent years is most satellites have a 10 or 15 year lifespan is what they're designed for. And an increasing number of companies, SpaceX included that you just mentioned, are building in extra plans so that when they reach near that end, that they can reserve some fuel to deorbit it so that the satellite would burn up in, safely over the Pacific Ocean, or which is like the dumping ground apparently of humanity when it comes to things from space. So that is something, but when something does go wrong, and then who's responsible for it? You know, that is something that we are going to have to figure out. You know, we've seen satellites fall uncontrolled over time. China's, I think they're one of their Tiangong labs, the early ones, came back to Earth, and they really didn't know where it was going to come, and no one knew like what would they be responsible for it when it hit the ground? Is it going to hit over a populated area? And luckily, I believe it ended up just kind of burning up over an ocean somewhere unseen. But you know, as we've seen with Skylab, and that's a whole other space junk menace. These debris events in space, when they fall back to Earth, they can also cause risks on the surface too. So, and that's because big pieces of Skylab fell over Australia. Some landed on farms and whatnot. And you can go to a museum in Australia and see the remains of Skylab there.
But let's be fair. There's a lot of Australia to fall into that's not going to cause problems. I mean, people live on this little ring around the outside of the continent, and then the rest of it. But yes, it was a big deal. We do want these things to fall in the Great Pacific Graveyard, as I like to call it, preferably.
And I think there was a check that was sent to Australia from the United States to kind of admit so way back when. So that was one example of it. But that's always one of the kind of sticky areas about space is that if I build my own satellite, I really don't want anyone going up there and touching it because I put my own technology into it. And is there going to need to be a debris consortium like the UN, but for space junk in orbit, to kind of monitor all of that? There's a lot of interest in cleaning up space, but who's going to regulate that? Does it need to be regulated, or is it up to a company? Is it up to Intelsat, which has been contracting with Northrop Grumman to get tugs that will extend the life of their satellites? Is it up to them and every single satellite operator to do that? Or should there be like a central service that you can kind of call up like a Lyft or an Uber to come and get your junk and take it out of space?
I'd like
or like 1-800-GOT-JUNK. Like maybe they could just point at it and it disappears. So
or the AAA of space. So, one more thing we should mention is that nature can help. So space weather makes a difference. You talked about Skylab. One of the reasons Skylab crashed, I mean, there were plans to reboost it to a higher orbit with the space shuttle, but the shuttle was running late. And then we had an unexpectedly energetic solar max in that period. It's a 13-year period of solar activity, and solar max is when it's the most active. And when you get more energy coming from the sun, a couple of things happen. One is that it causes the Earth's atmosphere to expand, and that caused more drag on Skylab and brought it down faster than we expected. But that same phenomenon can bring down a lot of space junk. So if you've got the International Space Station and the Russian Space Station up in orbit during an active solar max period with an increased atmospheric density up there, those can be reboosted to higher altitudes, but all the loose garbage that's floating around up there, not all of it, but some of the lower bands, let's say, of that is going to be caught up in this slightly denser atmosphere and decelerated and brought down.
And as we found out, if you leave your bright, shiny new batch of Starlink satellites in a very low altitude,
that's right.
They will also be brought back down to Earth a few days after you put them in space, like SpaceX learned just recently. So it is a bit of a flip side. You have to plan for it for sure. And that's what some companies are doing that to try to leverage that weather effect or just drag in particular to clean up space junk.
Well, and something that I hadn't realized is that the pressure from the photons coming from the sun and the other energy particles can actually navigate some small bits of debris slowly over time back down the atmosphere, which is something I never really thought about. But as you said, new satellites are also designed to actively handle their deorbiting or move them up into graveyard orbits. But there's a couple of other technologies I just want to talk about very quickly that will help with this phenomenon. One of them is studies on vehicles that can go up and refuel satellites that are properly fitted for refueling and allow them to either move up into safer orbits or down into deorbiting orbits where they're going to come back and burn up, or just to continue their lifetime. But again, you've got international laws there. You know, you have to get permission from India, say, if you're going to dock with their satellite and refuel it. And of course, that's something they'd probably want. Larger objects can be rendezvous with and forced to deorbit with space tugs, as you mentioned. There's also what they call the Pac-Man capture model, which is basically going up with a big set of jaws and grabbing something and bring it down to a lower orbit for release.
You know who's doing that is Rocket Lab. They have a new rocket called Neutron, and the whole top of the first stage opens up like a giant hippo mouth and then closes. So I could see that, like, swallowing it up, like from what is that? Was it not Doctor No?
It was
You Only Live Twice.
Yes, right, that, with the big alligator mouth.
We keep very dramatic about James music. Bond here.
I know, but it is such a James Bond moment. And speaking of James Bond moment, lasers may be used because if you shine a laser, a significantly powerful laser, at a piece of space junk, two things happen. One, the actual pressure from the laser can change the orbit, but more importantly, you burn a little spot on that piece of junk, and the ablation of that burn caused by that burn actually is a brief propulsive moment, and down it goes. Of course, aiming lasers down towards the Earth from orbit gets some people upset, so you've got some weapons concerns there that, you know, we got an outer space treaty that dates back to 1967 and probably needs to be updated because we weren't thinking about huge lasers in orbit at that point much. Water sprays and electrostatic tethers. I had heard of the electrostatic tether because the Japanese tried that, although it wasn't successful, which would impart a charge to these objects and cause them to deorbit. But water sprays is a new one by me. Have you heard about that one?
No. But, you know, just kind of any way to knock something out of space.
Yeah.
Seems like that would be like that gives you a little bit of thrust if you spray something out. So
I suspect immediately into ice. So you're essentially shooting an ice stream at it. And the nice thing about that is these are solid objects that will impart a velocity to something in orbit that you want to bring down, but then it just melts, right? It's not going to matter. So all this is good, and there's nets and harpoons. I love the idea of space harpoons, by the way.
I was going to say, I wanted to mention the harpoon because they actually did it in space.
Yeah.
In 2019, Airbus built a little satellite called Remove Debris as part of a demonstration of how could you clean up space junk with the Surrey satellite technology. And they did this. It actually had a pen-size harpoon that they shot at a target, and they were able to hit it. They also, I think that one actually had a net too that it shot at a target. It had like all these weird things, like a Swiss Army knife, and then it was designed to drag itself out of space with a big drag sail. So there's like all these wild ideas, and I just wanted to point out that the U.S. military is interested not just in cleaning up debris, because of course the U.S. military has, you know, the Space Force has their own satellites, but they've got this new program called Orbital Prime, which sounds like a transformer, I know, but they want ideas to not just clean up debris or prevent it or extend the life of a satellite, like you were talking about with tugs and stuff, but it would be like a vehicle that could go up and say, hey, Intelsat, your satellite's dead, but your antenna's still good. I will cut off the antenna and I will store it and I will use it to build a new satellite in space that needs that antenna. So recycling this stuff in space before it becomes debris is something that the military is looking at, that some other companies are looking at to create maybe even a new economy that is more, that is avoiding the addition of new things by using what's up there but not needed anymore in a new way. So I think we're still a few years out from that, but the fact that they have a contract out for ideas this year, in fact, says that they're pretty serious about that kind of technology. And, you know, space junk is such a big problem that it's even caught the attention rod of Steve Wozniak of Apple co-founding fame. You know, he launched a new startup called Privateer that is aimed at, like, sending up satellites just to track all of this stuff. And so there's clearly a lot of interest of pursuing it as a service to both warn satellite operators of possible conjunctions, is what they call it, when a piece of debris is headed towards your satellite, or finding ways to clean it all up. And, you know, right now they're just kind of developing the systems that they need. But they're saying, you know, that they're looking at several hundred satellites to go up there and just track everything that's up there and try to take care of it before it's too late.
It's kind of interesting that you want to launch more satellites to deal with more space debris. Like hundreds, you know, that could potentially become a problem on their own, but yeah, we'll find ways to bring them all back.
Yeah. So, you know, there's other companies like Leo Labs that are tracking stuff with radar, and what Privateer wants with the WAS is to be, as they say, the Google Maps of space is what they want to be, to kind of map it all out so that, you know, if you're going to launch your mission right now, you might want to wait like a few seconds if you can, so that you can let that rocket stage fly overhead that you're not going to crash into on your way up to orbit. Or if you need to change orbits because you have a really fancy satellite that can do that, that you can do it safely and not, you know, encroach on the lane of another fellow space traveler. So
we should also probably point out that Leo Labs is an abbreviation for Low Earth Orbit, not Leo Laporte, since we're right. on his
That's
network.
Right.
So yeah, there's a lot needs to be done here. Great opportunities for private industry, though, and there's a lot of people looking into that because this could be an area of great profit once it's properly supported. But that's going to require a lot of international negotiations, and that probably will and should go through what is called the UN COPUOS, a rather strangled acronym, the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. So we'll bring you more news as we hear it. But that's what we know about orbital debris today. We did get, roll the fanfare, please, we did get some fan mail congratulating us for our episode on model rocketry, but pointing out, as I'm not sure we did, that if you want to engage in model rocketry safely and productively, you should look at the National Association of Rocketry at NAR.org. That's NAR.org, which is an organization that's been around since I was young in the Jurassic era, although it didn't have a website at the time for obvious reasons. We were still dialing our telephones. But they have all kinds of resources and guides and different kinds of advice on how to do this safely and productively. And that's something we should, of course, encourage, because there are people out there, thank goodness, most of them, that are a lot more responsible than I was with model rocket. And I think, weren't you an NAR member at one point?
Maybe when I was in school. I should probably look to join them again, I think, just because I'm getting into it a lot more.
So thanks for listening, and we'd love to hear from you, good, bad, or indifferent. So if you'd like to talk to us, please connect with us at twis@twit.tv. That's TWIS for This Week of Space, @twit.tv. New episodes publish every Friday, and we're available on your favorite podcatcher, so make sure to subscribe and tell your friends, all of them. You can head over to our website at twit.tv/TWIS. See you next time.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed, with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.